This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video. Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. Only this time, we're doing another special interview. This time, I'm talking with Matt Welsh from Harvard University. Matt has done some cool stuff with remote RF sensors and volcanoes, but I'm going to let him tell you what this is all about in his own words. Welcome to the show, Matt. It's great to have you here today.
Thanks for having me.
Matt, let's first start out by telling the listener a little bit about who is Matt Welsh and why should we be listening to this for the next few minutes.
I hope I can make it worth your while. I'm a professor at Harvard in computer science. I've been around the Linux world for a long time. A lot of people ask me, are you the guy who wrote that Linux book? And I have to say, yes, that was me. In fact, I wrote that as a sophomore in college.
Oh, my.
And people were surprised to often hear that. This is the book Running Linux from O'Reilly. It's actually in the fifth edition now, and for the most part, I don't work on the book anymore. But I used to do a bunch of work in the Linux world, Linux documentation project, ran a bunch of websites. I ran the first Linux website.
No kidding.
So most people are like, wow, really? You ran that? The first, basically the first Linux website, or one of the first, like, two.
I have to ask, which distribution of Linux was that?
Oh, way back in the day, let's see, this would have been the SLS distribution. There was a two or three at the time. Something called SLS and then something called Slackware came along. So this is around that era. 1991, 92 was when I got involved with Linux, and then around 93, 94 when the first websites came around.
That's
so I've been around
back.
Linux for a long time, but I don't do Linux things that much anymore. I use Linux a lot, of course, but my research has to do with wireless sensors, which is, I think, why we're talking today.
Yes.
That's right. So one of the projects that we do involves using small wireless sensors for monitoring volcanoes. And the project is something that we got started about two and a half years ago. And before this, of course, I knew nothing about volcanoes. Never did any work on them. And when we started talking with the seismologists and the volcanologists and the project, they were saying things like, well, we are interested in putting these little sensors on erupting volcanoes in places like Ecuador and Antarctica and Mexico and Colombia. And I said, okay, I'm on. I'm sold. Ready to work on this. The project that we've done, and this is the subject of a paper that's going to be published at OSDI, which is one of the premier systems conferences,
operating systems.
Design and implementation. Mm-hmm. We have a paper coming up in that conference later this year. Is about using small wireless sensors to monitor eruptions and explosions at volcanoes. Now, volcanoes are something that sensors have been used on volcanoes for many, many years, but the sensors that are typically used are very large, fairly power-hungry. They are connected to car batteries and things like that.
Well, that right there tells me that I wouldn't want to lug one of those up the side of any hill.
That's exactly right. So when we've done these experiments with the seismologists, they carry their equipment along as well. And it's amazing the difference in the size and weight. They carry the sensors, the data loggers, all the cables, the batteries. And a car battery is just, I don't know how much it weighs. It's extremely heavy.
Oh, yeah, it's like 25, 30 pounds.
I mean, more than that sometimes, I think. And they have to carry everything more or less by hand. Because in many of the places that they deploy the sensors, it's impossible to reach those locations by road. And there's no way of getting pack animals on the trail because if you've got very thick jungle and very narrow, muddy trails, it would be treacherous for a horse or something to carry the equipment for you. So the people carry the equipment. Because of how heavy and bulky it is, it limits their ability to put more than a couple of sensors around a volcano mm-hmm. at a time. It's also very expensive. The equipment that they use, a single sensor station will be $10,000 or more for all of the pieces of that station.
Wow.
So it's both the money and the just the weight, the bulk of the equipment, is a real limiting factor.
Well, because of what you're studying, it's pretty much disposable.
Well, it's not necessarily disposable. That's one interesting thing, is that a lot of the times when we study volcanoes, the sensors are placed in locations that are close to the volcano, but not so close that they're likely to get destroyed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there are cases where it depends on what you're doing. The type of work that we're looking at is really seismic studies, meaning we want to monitor the ground motion generated by the volcano
okay.
as it erupts. So those kinds of sensors, the standard sensor is called a seismometer. This is the same thing you use to study earthquakes,
mm-hmm.
which is effectively, it's a large cylinder, you bury it in the ground, and it's got a weight inside and a spring, and it measures the movement of that weight up and down or horizontally as an earthquake occurs inside the volcano.
And usually the seismic activity is indicative that an eruption is imminent kind of thing.
There's all kinds of things that cause seismic activity. Clearly, earthquakes that can be related to eruption. So if you have an eruption, you're definitely getting some seismic activity.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there's plenty of small, really tiny earthquakes that happen inside of a volcano that really have nothing to do with an eruption or anything that's hazardous. But that the signals about that earthquake tell the volcanologist a lot about what is happening inside the volcano. So they can understand how the magma is moving inside, about gases expanding, rocks fracturing inside the volcano, things like that. So much of the work that they do is really focused on understanding the physical processes inside the volcano, regardless of whether the thing is actually erupting.
Interesting. So they came to you and said, we need a lighter package, or what was the collaboration that went on there?
Well, the way this got started was actually a former graduate student from Harvard in computer science, which is my department, used to work for one of these seismologists who's at University of North Carolina. And he said, you know, these wireless sensors of yours would be really useful for monitoring volcanoes. And I kind of laughed it off and said, yeah, sure. You know, I didn't actually think that the work that we were doing was at all relevant to what they wanted. But he brokered a phone call with these guys, and the collaborators are Jonathan Lees at UNC and Jeff Johnson at UNH, had a phone meeting with them, and Jeff and Jonathan said, oh yeah, well, what we're looking for is some way of putting a smaller, lighter weight sensor on the volcano, and this is really critical, getting the data in real time.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the sensor stations that are used at volcanoes basically are attached to a data logger. It's a lunchbox-sized, basically plastic box that you put all this, you put the cables in to the for the sensor,
mm-hmm.
and you plug in a micro drive or a compact flash card. It records the data onto the compact flash card. And then every week or so, they have to go back to that station and retrieve the compact flash card to download the data off of it. So it's a very manual process.
So they wanted real time, which would indicate RF or
some other kind of telemetry to get the data in real time, as opposed to having to visit the recording station
mm-hmm.
once a week. For example, they'll put these stations out there, and they won't know for a week or several days whether they got good signals or not. And if there's a big eruption or something while the station's there, they don't get to go look at the data immediately. They have to wait until they can go back to the station and retrieve the data. And these stations are very hard to reach, I think, as I've explained. It can take a full day just to reach the place where your station is located. So you don't want to do, you can't do that every single day. One of the main values of the wireless communication is just to get the data in real time so that you can look at it on a computer screen as it's being acquired.
Sure.
So that was exciting for them.
This is David Levy, amateur astronomer, lover of the night sky, and comet discoverer. You are listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Now, what are you using for that telemetry? Is it 802.11b that, you know, our Wi-Fi is based on, or is it something else?
Yeah, so it's a relatively new standard called 802.15.4, which is a low-power wireless communication standard. Some people have heard of Zigbee. Mm-hmm. Zigbee is a networking stack that sits on top of 802.15.4. So there's a confusion there. We don't use Zigbee as a networking stack, but we do use the 802.15.4 radios.
Okay.
802.15.4 is low data rate. The max is 250 kilobits a second. It's a lot less than 802.11. But it's also very, very low power. The chip, the radio is a single chip. It costs about $5. And it consumes about 20 to 30 milliamps. And that means that you can run this thing off of, in our case, we ran it off of D-cell batteries for, you know, weeks or more.
Wow. So in that case, it was the right tool for the right job.
Well, the radio bandwidth is very limited, so that ends up being a problem. But the low power means that we could really put these little sensors out there on the volcano and forget about them for a while. And only have it to go back and change the batteries infrequently. If we tried to use 802.11, the power consumption would probably be much higher, mm-hmm. and it would not have been able to run for many, many days without going back and changing batteries.
Well, let's talk about what's at the heart of this sensor, the hardware and the software. How did you put this all together?
So the sensor is based on a device called a MOAT, and this is a class of wireless sensor device that basically has a low-power processor. It's like a little 8 megahertz, 16-bit embedded processor. It has this radio that I talked about, mm-hmm. and it has, in our case, we added on ADC, analog-to-digital converters, to acquire the data from the sensors and digitize that data. The whole thing is fits in a small case about the size of a, it's a little bit hard to explain, about the size of a small cassette player, maybe is the right way of thinking about it.
Okay.
Or even it's about, I don't know, 6 inches by 4 inches by 2 inches high or something like that. And each one of those devices has connected to it various sensors. In our case, we used seismometers that I described earlier, mm-hmm. these cylinders you bury in the ground, and microphones. The microphones are there to pick up the acoustic signal generated by the volcano when it's erupting. This acoustic signal is very low frequency. It's way below the range of human hearing. So you can hear the volcano as it erupts, but the data that we're interested in is way below the range of human hearing. It's called infrasound, which is low frequency acoustic.
Interesting. So if you wanted to hear that, you could record it and then, you know, speed it up.
That's what we do.
Okay.
So you can think of it as an air pressure wave that's being pushed out by the volcano as it erupts. And so that one of the reasons that's interesting is if we receive a seismic signal, that could either be due to an earthquake inside the volcano, or it could be due to an explosion or an eruption at the surface. And the acoustic data will tell you which it is.
Now, the thing that I found interesting was there's really no way to test this other than to get it out in the field. And when you thought you had everything locked down and working, got out there to, I think it was at the volcano in Ecuador, it didn't mm-hmm. quite work as advertised. What were some of the interesting challenges you had there?
Well, we knew there was going to be a lot of problems. And one of the great things about this project is trying to get out there and use this technology and get it to the point where it will be useful for real scientists. So we developed the whole system ourselves. It's a research platform. It's not just a commercial thing that you go buy. And so obviously it's not as high quality as a commercial product, but it's doing something that I think is fairly bleeding edge. So we get out there, we deployed 16 sensors in a line running up and down the side of the volcano. The sensors ran there for about 3 weeks. This is at a volcano in Ecuador called Reventador. If anybody knows Ecuador, this is about 3 hours from the capital city of Quito. And it should be said, this volcano is very, very active. It erupts. We had explosions, eruptions, and earthquakes dozens or hundreds of times a day while we were there.
Wow.
Including a few really spectacular eruptions where the volcano was shooting these hot rocks out of the top just that were flying through the air and crashing on the ground all around. One thing that's important is most people, when they think of a volcano, they think of something like the Discovery Channel where you see this lava oozing out and things like that. It's not like that. That's a kind of volcano that you get in places like Hawaii. This is a more explosive volcano, so when it erupts, it really shoots this column of gas and ash high into the air and all these hot rocks shower out of the vent.
Is there also pyroclastic flow in this one?
In this, you can definitely get pyroclastic flows out of this volcano. Pyroclastic flow is this cloud of hot ash and rock that basically destroys anything in its path.
Nasty stuff.
In 2002, there was a large eruption there that had a pyroclastic flow that basically destroyed the entire forest for miles around the volcano. So when we're on the volcano now, it's completely dense jungle. You come out into this clearing, and it's like being on the surface of the moon.
Worse than Mount St. Helens.
Yeah, it's sort of like that.
Okay. So these sensors didn't work. Did you have to go back and retool them or make some tweaks and go back to the volcano and deploy them again?
Yeah, so there's a lot of problems when we got out there. So first of all, we get out there, we set up our sensors, we set up all the connections, the wires, the cables, all the sensors, everything. The sensors initially started collecting data, and we're very excited because for the most part things were working at first. We had the sensors were detecting earthquakes, and they would transmit the signal from the earthquakes back to our little observatory, which was a four-hour hike away from the volcano. So we had a laptop set up there to receive the data. At first, we were looking at the signal, and we were very excited. It was great. We were seeing basically what we had expected to see. And then, of course, when we started taking a closer look, we realized that some of the sensors, the timing of the data was not quite right. Now, I should rewind a little bit. When you study seismic data, the most important thing is the timing of the signals.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that is the seismologists want to look at all the data lined up in time, and it's got to be very, very accurate, down to milliseconds. So if I look at the data from sensor A and sensor B, I should be able to put them side by side on a plot, and the timing should line up perfectly. The timing tells them many things about the what's going on inside of the volcano, how fast are the waves propagating inside the volcano, things like that. We're looking at our data, and it looked good, but then when we lined it up on the time plot, the timing was all screwy.
Oh.
There's a lot of reasons for that. It turned out that there's basically a very, very small bug in our software that each of the sensors has a clock on it, and the bug was basically reading a bogus value for the clock in very rare occasions. And this, if it read a bogus value for the clock, it would throw off the timing until you rebooted the sensor. So it was one of these problems that as soon as it cropped up, you couldn't get rid of it until you rebooted the node.
Could you do your software update over the network, or did you have to bring each unit in?
Yeah, so that was the second problem. So we had built in some software to let us reprogram the sensors over the radio. You got to keep in mind, we're a four-hour and very grueling hike from the sensors, so you don't just walk up to them and hit a reset button.
right?
And to get up to where the sensors were would... It takes half a day, and you don't want to carry the laptop and the cables and everything to reprogram them. So we had thought ahead, and we put the software on the sensors to let us reprogram them. The problem was, at one point, we sent a command over the radio to tell all the sensors to reboot themselves because they were seeing this timing problem.
Uh-huh.
and they never came up again. So it's like the problem with the Mars Pathfinder. As soon as it got to Mars, they were finding the software problem, and they had to reboot it remotely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is everyone's worst nightmare, is you send the reboot command, and it never comes back up. That ended up happening to us. We don't really know what happened. There's clearly some strange software thing that we aren't quite sure. So my graduate student, fortunately I was safely back in the U.S. at this time, my graduate student had to hike up the volcano with his laptop in his backpack and go to each one of the sensors one by one and plug his laptop into it and reprogram it, fix the bug, and then go to the next sensor and repeat.
How many sensors?
There are 16 of them, but they're very far apart from each other. Each one is maybe 200 or so meters, 200 to 300 meters. So the hike from the lowest sensor to the highest sensor on the volcano, because it's very steep, is really pretty much a half day or few hour affair. So he was a real trooper. He fixed the network, and from then on, things were working very, very well. In fact, we got a lot of very good, juicy data from the volcano during the remaining time that the sensor network was there. And then at the end of the deployment, about the day before we took the sensors down, one of the sensors stopped reporting data, just one of them.
Hmm.
And it turned out to be the sensor that was highest up on the volcano. So we were scratching our heads. We didn't quite know what was going on. When they went to remove the sensor, they saw that the antenna, that the radio antenna that had been attached to the sensor, was completely destroyed. It was gone. And the pole that the antenna had been attached to was basically chopped in half. And the only thing that could have possibly caused that was an eruption, that one of these hot rocks flying out of the volcano, sailing through the air and basically slicing the antenna mast in half.
Wow.
And we have a great photograph of this. I could not believe my eyes when I saw this picture, that the volcano really ended up nailing one of our sensors. It's pretty amazing.
This is John Chatterton from Deep Sea Detectives. You're with Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Now, I gotta ask, you're the co-author of Running Linux. Are these sensors running Linux?
Oh, no, of course not. So, we wish they were, but they only have 10 kilobytes of memory.
Oh, well, that makes it a little challenging.
Yeah, unfortunately, the one of the reasons that they have so little memory is because of the power consumption.
Sure.
These things are designed to run for weeks or months off of alkaline batteries. And so they only have 10 KB of RAM and about 60 KB of ROM for program memory. So there's no way you could really run Linux on it. But there are other devices that are being developed like this that have better processors. There's one from Intel called the iMote that has it runs Linux. And it's got the same radio and everything. It's higher power consumption, but if you had a better battery or something, you could imagine doing that.
Okay. So what's next for Matt?
I think the biggest thing that we're going to shoot for next summer is going back to the volcano and doing two things. I think the first is we want to put a larger number of sensors on the volcano to try to get a lot more data, but also to get better spatial coverage. I think I explained that the sensors on the volcano were basically sitting in a line.
Mm-hmm.
That limits the ability to see different signals from different parts of the volcano. So what we want to do is put two or three different lines of sensors in different sides of the volcano, basically, to get more information. The second thing is, this last summer, our sensors effectively just collected data. The volcano would erupt, and we would capture 60 seconds of data from each of the sensors. Instead, what we want to do is actually have the sensors do some intelligent processing of the data. The biggest reason to do this is to reduce the power consumption even further. So one way of thinking about this is, for every packet of radio data that you send, it costs the same amount of energy as doing several thousand cycles of CPU.
Hmm.
So if I can do more processing of the data as it's being collected, you get to save a lot of energy in terms of how much radio communication you have to do. So the goal for next summer is to make this really an intelligent sensor array. One of the things we want to do is have the network automatically detect the location of the earthquake within the volcano. Ooh. The way of thinking about this is there's an earthquake, and it starts somewhere inside the volcano. It could happen near the surface if it's an explosion. It could happen deep inside if something else is going on. If we could determine the 3D location of that earthquake inside the volcano in real time, that would tell the seismologists a lot about, well, what kind of explosion is it? What kind of earthquake activity is going on? If the earthquakes start to get closer and closer to the surface of the volcano, it might be getting ready to erupt. And by having the sensors do this processing and only send information over their radio about the location of the earthquake, instead of sending the full signal, we're saving a huge amount of energy, and that means the network can last for longer and potentially be left there for months at a time.
Well, I wish you well on that. Good coding to you. You're in the computer science division, right? You, all of this knowledge you just spewed at me was just learned from this project?
For the most part.
Wow, that's amazing.
I mean, I'm not a volcanologist.
Yeah, see, that was my mistake.
On this, the first slide in my talk is always the IANAS. I am not a seismologist. Because I don't want the audience to think I know more about volcanoes than I really do.
Well, Matt, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for being on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Appreciate it.
And I appreciate you listening to this interview. If you like this and want to listen to more interesting interviews, such as the one you just heard, check out the webpage at chuckchat.com/technorama and click on Interviews on the left. You can also join us for a bit of geek fun and original humor on the regular Technorama shows twice a week. Head over to chuckchat.com and poke around. Thanks for listening, and until next time, a binary high five. 101.